Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, this is the BBC. We are the official spokespeople for the next couple of hours, and we're here to talk movies and to read out assorted emails and to chuckle and guffaw at various points.
When you say assorted, you mean this week an absolute bucket load.
Yeah, as I said to Rachel earlier, we've never ever had as many emails about one film as we've had about Inception. We could talk from now till four about Inception, just based on the emails that we've received. This would clearly be an unwise idea because we wouldn't get through any reviews at all, and there's lots of Toy Story 3 correspondence as well. But it is extraordinary. So what we'll do is we'll get to Oliver Stone round about 2:15. You can hear the interview that he did with Mark there. We'll do the box office top 10, and we'll talk about Inception after 2:30. We'll talk about Toy Story 3 because a lot of people have seen it already, even though it's only out today.
In theory, yes, but of course it was actually out last week through the miracle of preview screenings.
Alison Edwards, Dear Chuckles and Mr. Pricklepants. I'm not sure who I'd rather be or who they are.
No, anyway, I'm lost.
I am currently playing Lego Harry Potter, years 1 to 4, okay, on the Wii console.
Yeah, yeah.
And was very surprised when Jason Isaacs popped up on my screen in Lego form. And without thinking, I said out loud, Hello, Jason. No. Hello, Lego Jason Isaacs. Does this incarnation of Mr. Isaacs count as the most unusual to date? I like that.
I must get that.
Lego Jason Isaacs is a game all in itself.
There's somebody on the internet does these things, minifigs, which are little mini characters.
I'm going to go to a toy shop and ask for one. I just want to assemble a Lego
Jason Isaacs. Yeah.
James in Melbourne. Since the birth of my daughter, the only time I can get to listen to your programme is during my run around the Tan, which is the botanical gardens in Melbourne, Australia. We call it the Tan. My iPod is... as well as enabling me to listen to you both wittertaining, also records my speed, you might like to know. Over the past 6 months, I've noticed that when Mark has seen only good or average films, my run is fairly poor or average. But when he's seen a film that really upsets him, my run is markedly faster. A quick bit of simple graphing has proved to me that my running speed is inversely proportional to the quality of films being shown on UK cinemas, or more precisely the choices Mr. K makes when deciding which films to see and review. As you're both very keen on saving people's lives, as we have been recently, I ask, in order to improve my health and therefore save my life, and because I've entered a fun run in a couple of weeks and don't want to embarrass myself, can Mark please go and see some terrible films? Also, if it's not too much of an imposition, can he talk about them 40 minutes into the show, which is the time I try to pick up the speed before I finish? I'm happy to provide the graphs if you wish.
Well, I mean, as far as the choosing...
He's been running slow recently.
I go and see what the preview screenings are, so there isn't a choice involved in that. And whether they're any good or not is really not down to me. It's more down to the producers.
Yeah, so just get yourself fit, James, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
You've got a lovely place to run around. Just get yourself sorted.
I'm impressed by the fact that he's done a graph of this. I mean...
He's offered to send it to
time,
you.
Time, hands... Has he, really?
Yeah, thanks for that. Tom, on this is Tom, BA Honours, MA Human Values and Contemporary Global Ethics, distinction. Dear Cillian Murphy's Subconscious and Cillian Murphy's Subconscious.
Very good. Which one of those are we in? Ellen Page.
A quick word regarding the recent thread of films to nurse one through a breakup. I'm currently barrelling toward one like a projected freight train through a busy dream world street, and have found it necessary to bring out the big guns. Three films that have never failed to cheer me up when watched individually.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that the triple bill will make me forget the whole thing ever happened. I'd like to hear what the good doctor thinks of this triumvirate of comfort viewing by dint of his snappy one-word reviews.
Uh-huh.
Are you ready to go?
Yeah.
So bear in mind, he's in a delicate place.
Yeah, but he's barreling towards the breakup, but he hasn't actually broken up.
Well, I think, you know...
If he's sending us an email...
He knows what's coming.
Yeah. You know, the writing's on the wall,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Okay. So, snappy one-word review. And bear in mind, this is comfort viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Big.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, yes, it is very comfortable viewing. And I have bounced up and down on that piano, the toy store piano that's in America.
Parenthood.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it's fine. I mean, interesting choice for comfort viewing, but there's a couple of
angsty parent viewing.
And
finally, Groundhog Day.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, Groundhog Day will cheer you up at any time. In fact, any Bill Murray triple bill would work. Why don't you just do a Bill Murray triple bill?
If any more suggestions come in, says Tom in W2, please enlighten me, as I will certainly be needing them. I did snap up a 6-film Woody Allen box set for a mere tenner in preparation, but I fear it won't be enough. Danny on this, dear Hawkeye and Chingagook. Is that right?
Well, I'm going to be Hawkeye, whatever you're going to be.
Okay. Long-time listener via the podcast, which has saved my mental health during many long business trips. Your recent chat about the podcast putting people to sleep reminded me to contact you to tell you that you have helped us with the tricky problem of getting our 10-year-old daughter to get to sleep. We've tried all sorts of non-pharmaceutical strategies, but she really struggles to fall asleep at night. The only regularly successful tactic has been to put on your dulcet tones to leave her absorbed. She usually goes over in a few minutes. The whole house salutes you. If you've got a troublesome 10-year-old who won't go to sleep, this is the show for you. There are so many good health qualities to this programme.
Can we get a grant?
That is a very, very good idea.
Let's apply.
From the NHS?
Yeah, I don't mind. From anyone. Let's see if we can get a grant on the grounds of the fact that we're good for you.
Yes. I think we should be available on prescription.
Mm.
I think we're being live streamed, by the way. You might want to look at the website for that. Because obviously it won't appear anywhere else.
No.
Craig, normally of Evesham, but stuck in America. I'm working in Chicago.
Oh, Chicago's lovely.
And Transformers 3 is being filmed outside my hotel.
And go out now and shout.
Wait! I wasn't brave enough to shout, just stop as I drove past on an open-top bus, but I was thinking it on the inside. Does that count for anything?
No, it doesn't, because Transformers is one of the movies in which you are morally impelled to actually get up and shout stop. One of the things that's fascinating, but people will have seen this in the news, the makers of Transformers 2, have all admitted now that it was rubbish. They've all said, yeah, we dropped the ball badly with Transformers 2. There was an article in Empire recently in which I think Shia LaBeouf was quoted as saying, yeah, you know, we'll be the first to admit that it was all over. No, at the time, none of you were admitting it. I'm very glad to see that all this time after you've all caught up. And yes, we were right. You were wrong. It was dreadful.
Do you remember...
Somehow the fact that they know it's dreadful kind of makes it worse. It's like if they had no concept of its dreadful. And you know Megan Fox isn't in the new film.
You said Megan Fox without standing up and raising your backside.
No, because Megan Fox is now the ex-Megan Fox of the Transformers franchise. She's now been replaced by a lingerie model from his Victoria's Secret shoot. So I expect it will be every bit as high-thesping quality as before. But Megan Fox and Michael Bay have officially fallen out.
Straight to Channel 5.
Yes.
That's what will happen to that. You know, we were talking about working-class addresses and middle-class addresses Acacia Avenue, yeah, absolutely.
Ooh.
Here is... I'm going to talk about power addresses. I have never seen an address more powerful than this email. If you live in a more powerful address, send one in. Mm-hmm. This is from Jake Marini, Chief of Staff, Office of the President, Thomas Jefferson University, Philadelphia, PA. How great is that? The email's a bit disappointing, but I just wanted to mention that we'd had an email from Jake Marini, Chief of Staff, Office of the President, Thomas Jefferson University, Philadelphia, PA. The email.
Email says, is there an email as well?
Yeah.
It's not just the address, okay.
Dear Simon and Callow, just saw a headline that says they're making a sequel to The Last Airbender. Does that make the more recent film the penultimate
Airbender.
So,
very good.
There you go. So thanks, Jake Marini, Chief of Staff.
I once lived at number 1 Mornington Crescent.
That's not a power address, but it's a funny address.
Yeah, because it's, you know...
Comedic overtones.
Exactly.
According to Mrs. Trellis in North Wales.
Just round the corner from Mark Lamar, who lived in Mornington Terrace, bizarrely. We used to get each other's mail.
Alex, BA in History, MSc Political Science in Amsterdam. Dear Mr. and Dr. Doctor, following the good doctor's complaint of all three of the IMDb reviews he could find of La Blonde au Sein Nu.
You found them, not me. Indeed. Oh, no, I did. I printed them off for you, yes.
Okay.
La Blonde au Sein Nu, which translates as...
The blonde with bare breasts.
With bare breasts, occasionally.
Yes. Here is his short review, which he's translated. For.
Oh, is this a proper review?
Well, this is a synopsis, but it's slightly more intelligent.
But
than
written by him or translated?
I don't know. Well, let's just enter the world of Alex at BA History in Amsterdam. Two brothers live on a boat in Paris and try to make ends meet by stealing and hustling their way through life. They steal the painting, La Blonde au Sein Nu, from the Musée d'Orsay, but end up kidnapping the beautiful museum employee as well. Yes, she's blonde, and yes, occasionally, you know. With the girl and the painting locked up in in the hull of their ship, they embark on a journey.
Ba-boom.
In which the girl turns out to be more than they bargained for at first, but more than they could have hoped for in the end. Brave attempt of a film, says Alex, with talented young actors, but be warned, as the character who spends the most of the time with his top off is actually the 11-year-old playing one of the brothers.
Okay.
So
it sounds fairly poor, but...
It does, just based on that.
But it's a French comedy, right? In the manner of that other one that's in the charts at the moment.
In the charts?
Yes. It'll be in the top 10. Heartbreaker.
Thanks to Mark and the Dodge Brothers, says Tim of Wokingham, for their excellent accompaniment to Beggars of Life at the Lima Tree Festival. I can pay no greater tribute than to say I was riveted to the film, not the band.
Very good.
The latter just made the whole thing so complete. Just the thought, was the lead actor Harrison Ford's dad? This is because you were at Lima Tree last week.
And we did played an accompaniment to this Louise Brooks film from the 1920s called Beggars of Life, which is an extraordinary piece of work with Louise Brooks and Wallace Beery, and it's a really, really wonderful, very dark, very strange film.
By the way, says Tim, with reference to the Dodge Brothers set, if you ask the audience if they want more bass, everyone under 25 will yell yes. The youngsters in front of me then got up and left halfway through the next number, while poor old me could hardly breathe for the pounding in my chest cavity until you turned it back down. You're not Motorhead.
Well, in my head.
And here's a maxim for life. Next time you get sent off to empty the chemical toilet, use a trolley. Is his
mate. Yeah, I was. Many people, as I was going to empty the chemical toilet from the caravan, all thought it was appropriate to quip, "Haven't you got someone to do that for you?"
Meantime, I was at Latitude interviewing Paul Greengrass.
Did you empty a chemical toilet?
Of course not, no.
Oh, you have got someone to do that for you.
Paul Greengrass was there, although you kept on confusing him with Dave Morrissey. Vinay in Lambeth says, I was lucky enough to be at Latitude. Considering last week's confusion of whether you were interviewing David Morrissey, imagine my own real shock when I found myself standing next to the very man himself in the interview with Paul Greengrass. He blinked at me in a very startled manner. Possibly he was just as surprised to see me as I was to see him. Maybe he thought the casual backpack that he was wearing made him invisible, Harry Potter style, to the glares of braying fanboys, of which I'm not one, although he wasn't half bad in State of Play. Anyway, then he went to see Oil City Confidential, and he loved it. A proper film indeed. So, enough guff. So, Oliver Stone is on the way.
Yeah.
An interview which you did, and it did make me think Oliver Stone, Fidel Castro, Mark Kermode in the same room. Who is the most... Well, obviously Fidel Castro's not in the same room.
Well, I should say,
which is the more left wing of the three?
And, I mean, obviously, the one thing, and I'd be the first to admit this, obviously, the one thing that we lacked in this interview was your journalistic, you know, fighting bull.
Are
in
you apologising for the interview before it goes out?
No, no,
I'm just apologise for it afterwards.
No, I'm not apologising, but I'm just saying that, you know, I'm the film critic, you're the hardened political toughie. I like Oliver Stone.
Just there for balance.
Yes, exactly.
Right, okay, so that's on the way, and you might be watching us online, bbc.co.uk.
UK,
indeed. And you can watch the interview with Oliver Stone.
Can you?
Which is very good. So if you are watching, refresh your page in a few seconds.
This is like an episode of Inception, isn't it? Sorry, whose subconscious are we in when
you're watching? If you refresh the page, Mr. Stone will magically appear. And if you're not watching us online, go to the Five Live website. You can watch the video interview with Oliver Stone. And if you're a podcast listener, it'll all be on the programme page. Mark hasn't understood a word
of that
radio at all. Wavy Dave from New York. I listened to the podcast on my commute into New York City. Last Tuesday, I was enjoying the good doctor's review of Twiglet when a fight broke out in front of me on the subway. After the flying fists to the face subsided and police officers dragged the three men off the train, my adrenaline was still pumping and I was quite shaken up. Continuing to listen to your programme calmed me down and saved me from heat failure and permanent emotional damage from witnessing such a trauma. Another reason why we should be available on the NHS.
On the NHS.
So set the scene then for us for your Oliver Stone exclusive.
So Oliver Stone has got a new movie. I mean, he just produced movies at a rate of knots. He's made this film, South of the Border, which is essentially a documentary in which he goes around talking to South American leaders like Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales and Luis de Silva. And one of the things that he said his guiding principle was to give these people a chance to talk and to have their voices aired, because living in America as he does, that you don't hear their voices very often in the news media. And I, one of the reasons I like the film so much was that it was a film in which Oliver Stone does a lot of listening, which was
You're just teeing up the interview, by the way, not reviewing the film at the moment.
Oh, fine. Okay. He does a lot of listening, but here he is talking. Does that work?
That's perfect.
It started as a road trip, really. I was doing
rather light. I mean, in a sense, I went to see Hugo Chavez, who I'd known before, and I interviewed him, and he's a wonderful interview, and he's a charismatic figure. And he said, don't take my word for it in this country. Go and see the other countries in this region. We're all in this together. This is a continent that's waking up. He quoted Simon Bolivar. And I did. I took. He made it easy access to the other six leaders in six countries, and I saw them. And it's definitely something going on that has changed. Before, if you think about your own experience in Latin America, whenever a reform candidate would come along, the United States would basically remove them or pick them off because they came along as individuals, whether it was in Chile in 1973 or if it was Guatemala in 1954. Always constant. There was more than 50 attempts, 50 coups in that region by the United States to remove these people. So this is the first time they haven't been able to. They tried, which, as we make that point in the movie, there's a depiction of the coup attempt in 2002 to remove him. And we have documents that show the United States was involved and knew about it up front and denied it. So Chavez has his own problems in the United States, but he has forgiven it and he moved ahead. He was trying to reach out to the American people. They want to be friends, but the United States doesn't like these people and don't want them to continue in power.
You address head-on the issue that Chavez is regularly referred to as the dictator, as far as the American media is concerned. And you, obviously, if you go and speak to somebody who one section of the press thinks is a dictator, you're going to ruffle some feathers. Why do you think that label has stuck? Because you say clearly, human rights record isn't perfect, but there are people who have worse human rights records who we see as our best friends.
Yeah, it's so silly. What's this? It's semantics. I mean, the word dictator is just misused because he's been elected three times, twice reelected, with transparent majorities and also with transparent elections monitored by international organizations. Far more transparent than most of the elections of our allies in Latin America. So that issue is off the table. Human rights, there's no pattern of abuse. There's no systematic pattern. He's, on the contrary, he's a supporter of the law. He's trying to do things democratically. It's very tough in a country which has emerged from years of benighted leadership like that to maintain the laws, and there's so much corruption. Every time there's an instance of some malfeasance, something does go wrong in these countries, we blow it up in our headlines and we make him the enemy. It is about the right trying to take Chavez down, saying it's Chavez like Castro. They make him into an egomaniac. It's really a battle between the right and the left that's going on about control of resources, and the right will not give it up. Very ferocious opposition in Venezuela, Bolivia, all these countries. The press is privately owned by rich families. That's the end of the story. They make it impossible for change. They constantly are against reform, against any kind of thing that helps the people. So this is an ongoing battle that goes not only in South America but all over the world about America, the United States being against the interests of the poor people.
And do you have a similar battle with the United States media? Because obviously, as soon as you put, how does that play itself out?
Yeah, I didn't pick the battle. It's just that the media is there like a missile shield protecting the United States. It seems that they want to keep the people ignorant. Whether it's the Kennedy assassination or the changes that are going on around the world, there's a level of ignorance that appalls me. And in my films, I do the best I can. They're obviously entertainments, and they're supposed to be fun. And I like movies, but movies can also be a way to raise the consciousness of people.
Is there a fundamental difference between making the narrative movies and making documentaries?
Oh yeah. Certainly. A feature film, I approach it seriously. I do as much research as I can, but the ultimate aim is to make it entertaining. You don't tell the story unless you have some angle that makes it particularly gripping or tense, and then those are factors. A documentary sometimes doesn't have that tension, but a documentary will go right to the facts. I mean, this is a gripping story to me, but it's not. I don't see it as a narrative because it takes years to make economic changes. These people have lifted their people from poverty. In Venezuela, they cut the rate 50%. The changes in the economy, nobody ever talks about the basics, like the Venezuelan economy boomed from 2003 to 2008. Poverty was cut 50%. Extreme poverty was cut 70%. Yeah. Argentina was considered bankrupt in 2002. Bankrupt. It was devalued. The peso was done. And this Nestor Kirchner and Cristina, the Argentine economy revived, grew 62% in 5 years. So these issues are often like left aside as, quote, statistics and boring statistics. That's the tough part about making documentaries, because you don't want to give too many statistics. But documentaries are good for me as a filmmaker because they refresh my knowledge of life. Yeah. And I go out there into the field and I see real people, real leaders, and I get the feedback from them.
But what's interesting is, even in the case of your feature films, a lot of the time when you've been criticized in the press, the criticisms have been factual issues rather than whether it's a good or a bad film. I mean, for example, if JFK comes out or Nixon comes out or World Trade Center comes out, people say, oh, well, you know, we'll have a factual argument about it. It's like, even when you're making feature films, people are treating them as if they are documentary subjects.
No, I'm judged, I think, by another standard now. And I don't know. I think people have a hard time getting their description around me. I don't quite fall into an easy crack here. It's true. I do. You know, if it's always fair and it's always not fair and balanced. I mean, the truth is, if the Chavez movie, for example, it would only be fair and balanced if it was critical of Chavez to some people. The word fair and balanced means what it does. It's not an objective word.
Yeah.
Am I supposed to interview six people in the street who hate Chavez? If I interviewed three that liked him and three that hate him, they'd still say there's an imbalance, that it wasn't accurate. You never can win. You never can get it right, because none of us, frankly, even historians, are that objective. We bring to it our subjectivity. So I think the best thing I can do in a case like this is let these people talk for themselves.
Sure.
And these interviews are historically priceless, because at least at this moment in time, these people are on camera and they say what they feel about their countries. That's quite something, considering the state of our media, where we don't allow them to speak. We're always prosecuting attorneys, asking them hostile questions.
One of the things I like very much about the film is that you do hear those voices. And actually, from the point of view of your interviews, your questions are, you know, they're short, they're concise, and the primary voices that we hear are their voices. Since you're known as somebody who has such a prominent voice yourself, is that a very different approach for you?
I was the one critic was tearing me apart for saying it was my vanity trip. If anything, I thought I was pretty low key and kind of dull.
Yeah.
You can never win, but frankly, the way that you can get them to talk is because of who I am. I am a film director, and I'm not as threatening as a prosecuting journalist. You know, I'm there and I'm saying, look, tell me what you think is going on and what's happening in your country. And that's a very mild approach. I think that's sometimes yields the best results. I still maintain the film that never got released in the United States, my film on Castro called Comandante.
Yeah.
It's one of the best interviews with Fidel, because it allows him to speak. Really allows him to speak in a very relaxed setting and ask some questions at the same time. Some of them are provocative, but it was labeled as a hagiography in the United States, a fawning softball. On the contrary, as a result of seeing that movie, you see a side of him that you never see.
But I think we see a side of you that we haven't seen so much before, and that, you know, you have a reputation of being combative, but actually the primary register of South the Border is you listening. There's an awful lot of you listening in it.
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, if... Listen, Mark, you've been on the other, you know what's going on in the critical world. I mean, the movie critics in the United States in general, I would say, they can like the movie, and they can like the movie, but they will always say, well, I know that this is not the truth because it's Oliver Stone, therefore it's got to be some kind of agit-propaganda. But still, I enjoyed it because I learned things I didn't know. That would be the least they can give,
okay.
And that's what they do. I've never gotten unqualified, like, you know, wow, this really opened my eyes, because they know that I'm somehow holding something in cards in check. I don't think that's fair.
Is that only in America that happens, or is that an international
experience? I think the Western media is like been trained to doubt. The Western mind is so skeptical, that it doubts the intentions of these leaders who have truly helped the people. They have not been corrupt candidates. They haven't taken the money for themselves. By comparison, the criticism is not... Why is there not this major criticism of the regimes in Colombia or Mexico, or for that matter, Honduras? The coup in Honduras is a disgrace. And it went down recently. It went down right underneath our eyes. It's another story. It goes on and on. The United States did nothing. And seven journalists have disappeared in Honduras. There's cases of torture and abuse and murder. And Colombia people are being killed. So many people were killed in Colombia. That went by again. I don't know. It seems that only when we encounter a true reformer, do we question, do we really look at it with closed eyes, and then we become very critical of that reformer.
What about on a personal level? Because one of the interesting things is that you seem to genuinely like the company of many of these people. At one point when you're talking to Chavez, you say, I've never seen so much energy in a room before, which is a big praise coming from you. Did you find that you personally liked the people that you met?
I did. I am a film director. I suppose I tend to be people-oriented. I tend to, for example, I make a movie, I like my actors. Sometimes they may not like them in normal conditions, but they're in a context, and I fall in love with my actors. I wanted them to succeed. Perhaps I could be blamed for liking the people I interview, but I'm trying to make them come out and be the best of who they are.
Do you think that there was a change in your worldview as a result of 9/11? Because it was interesting, when you were doing the David Lean lecture and you were talking about World Trade Center, you sort of sounded a note of caution in that you felt that the subject was so extraordinary and such a radical change had happened in the world that one had to be very, very cautious about approaching it. And actually, you took some flack for it because some of the reviews of World Trade Center said, well, it's, you know, how do you even approach this subject?
That's a question. Again, I couldn't do it right. I mean, they said that the same thing was true of W, which was done 2 years later. In the World Trade Center, they said I was being... giving the American line, I was patriotic. I didn't look at it that way at all. I looked at it as a specific story about two Port Authority policemen who were stuck in this mess, and with an extraordinary story of survival, only 19 survivors. And I was fascinated by the mechanism by which they stayed alive. What was it that carried them into that spiritual realm that kept them going at the point of death?
Well, I thought the most extraordinary scene in that film is the vision of Christ coming with the bottle of water, which I think was completely non-ironic and was exactly as he had described it.
That's correct. Will Jimeno told me that story, and I illustrated it the way it happened to him because it was crucial to his survival, you see. And I don't think people understand that. It's not ironic. It's a question of mere survival, and that's what he saw.
People have said that you're unpatriotic, but you seem to me to be very patriotic. I mean, you know, you fought for your country. You seem to be very proud of the finer traditions of it. Do you see yourself as patriotic?
I don't like the word patriotic because that leads to war on all causes. You know, it's whether my soccer team is better than your soccer team. I think we're global citizens. Put it this way, I have a love of my country because I know it, and I grew up there, and I have an understanding for it, and I want to make it better. And I think that it causes much pain in the world and has brought much anguish and suffering to the poor populations of the world, whether it is in Vietnam or Iraq or recently in Afghanistan. It's and in South America, too, by fomenting coups and bringing bad leaders to the forefront. In Guatemala, for example, President Clinton is the only American president to apologize for genocide in the matter of Guatemala because of our involvement in those governments that killed so many people in that country. So, you know, we do have a role to play as responsible citizens. That's what America can be, a great country. It was conceived so. I think, I fought for America not because I agree with the Vietnam War. I didn't understand it. I was brainwashed, and I went there as an honest and loyal American. But then I woke up to the lies that this government told in Vietnam and the death. It's very hard to live with that, and we have a price to pay. But we have to start to wake up.
Oliver Stone talking to Mark earlier in the week, and the video of that interview, if you want to watch it, that'll be online. Let's do a box office top 10 at 10, The Concert.
Which I liked very much. And in fact, I was surprised by how much I liked it, because it is essentially a sort of flimsy tale about a group of musicians getting together to put on a concert under circumstances which practically couldn't happen. But actually, I got swept up in it. Melanie Laurent was very good, and it ends up in this great big musical performance, which brought tears to my eyes.
Leaving Partir, number 9.
Yes, well, it's an interesting film. It is definitely an actor's piece. I think Kristen Scott Thomas is very, very fine in it. There are, as I said, it's an interesting film because it divides your sympathies very much. I mean, you've seen it as well. And I'm wondering, the further away from it I get, whether the divided sympathies thing is in fact entirely intentional, and that's kind of the point. That was one of the things that I had a problem with when I first saw it. The more I think about it, the more I like it.
Sex in the City 2 at 8, you've kind of done that. Heartbreaker at 7?
Well, you know, Heartbreaker is a romantic comedy which says, don't marry that really nice, philanthropic, lovely, wealthy guy who loves you because he's English. Marry the horrible, rancid, wretched guy who's French.
Two French films in the top 10, which is an unusual thing, but none of them La Blonde au Seine Nu.
No. But you just like saying that, don't you?
Killers at 6.
Which is nothing like as funny as it ought to be.
Get Him to the Greek at 5.
Which is funnier than Killers by some distance, is still nothing like as funny as it needs to be in order to fully exploit Russell Brand's comic potential. But I did chuckle a couple of times.
Predators at 4.
Which is the second best Predator movie, which, considering the first Predator movie wasn't that great in the first place, it's still not saying that much.
Twilight Saga Eclipse at 3. So some correspondence here. Matt and wife.
Here we go.
Libby. There's Matt and Libby Turtle in Adelaide. Matt explains a lot of circumstances under which he went to see the film. Obviously, like, apologising for the fact that he went with his wife. Mm-hmm. My main problem with the film, and I don't know if this is the same as the book, because I haven't read it, says Matt, was the following plot point. Go Bella on. Is a strong, independent female character around whose choices the film revolves.
Thank you.
But physically, she is weak in comparison to the vampires and needs to be protected by pretty much everybody at some point in the film. She keeps on saying that this will change, but would it not have been a lot easier if she just got on with it at the start of the film? Bella is winging...
Got on with what?
Getting stronger.
What, you mean becoming a vampire?
Bella is willing for everyone else to risk their lives to protect her, but is unwilling to do the one thing that will allow her to protect herself and for no discernible reason.
No, the one thing that will protect her is becoming a vampire. She wants to become a vampire. Edward keeps saying, I don't want you to do that because the sacrifice is too great. But she begins and ends the film saying, I want to be a vampire.
Tina Stevens, MA Joint Honours, English Literature and Economic and Social History, PGCE English and History, Merit in Academic Studies. I am the head of English at an all-girls secondary school in Glasgow. I consider myself to be an expert on the Twiglet books, having read and discussed the minutiae of them with my pupils more times than I care to admit.
Is minutiae off Arcasia Avenue?
The speech that Bella gives in Eclipse that Mark cites constantly, it's not about you, it's about me, is not... in the book. I have no idea where the speech came from, but certainly not from Stephanie Meyer. Also, it has actually upset a lot of the core Twiglet fans, because in the books, Bella's decision to become a vampire is all about Edward, and they feel that this edition dilutes that relationship. As an English teacher, I am just annoyed that the writers of the screenplay felt the need to add depth to a character in a way that changes her from the book.
David Slade talked specifically about that scene, and he was very proud of it and was very clear that it was crucial. I mean, obviously there are certain departures from the book just by nature of it becoming a film, but he was very keen that essentially what that scene does is say something which is inherent in the book anyway. Now, obviously, that is a point which is up for debate, but I like that scene very much, and I think if you start talking about adaptations as having to be literally to take every word from the book, then there are going to be problems. I that is one of my favourite scenes in the film.
Lee Sellers says, please help me and my friend. My stupid friend claims that the Twilight Saga is better than the original Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that Mr. Kermode is not a fan of Star Wars whatsoever, but can he honestly say to 1 billion listeners that Twilight is better than the original Star Wars trilogy?
Okay.
He says, I'm not going to the pub this afternoon, so I can listen to your show live instead.
Yes.
Twilight's better than Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, dear, dear. Shrek Forever's at 2...
She's not as good as Shrek 3 or Shrek 2, but particularly not as good as Shrek 1.
Now, Inception is the UK's number one.
Is it, Simon? Has it gone straight in at number one?
It has gone straight in, Pop Pickers.
Like Slade releasing a single in the early 1970s, it's gone straight in at number one.
So let us just give you a coating, a dusting.
Let us tickle the waters of the correspondence.
Of the correspondence that has come in. As I mentioned at the beginning of the programme, more on this film than we have ever had in nearly 10 years of doing this show. Matt Coates, Grade 3 Violin, Halifax, UK. Dear Dream and Dream Within a Dream, just been to see Inception and was blown away. At last, proof, if proof were needed, that a blockbuster action thriller does not have to treat its audience like subhuman mouth breathers in order to be successful. Christopher Nolan and presumably Warner Brothers ought to be congratulated for actually asking some kind of intellectual engagement on behalf of their audience. An absolutely stunning piece of work. This from Greg. A brilliantly constructed smart movie that also has more than enough action to satisfy my shallower impulses. Just utterly brilliant. So thanks to the good doctor for inspiring me to go back to the cinema. I'm now looking for my nearest IMAX to see it in full effect. My next movie will probably be Tron Legacy, which I'm worried will be rubbish.
Can I just say on that, you've seen it in IMAX, right? You've seen Inception in IMAX, and you've also seen it in Ornery.
Yes. Well, here's the problem. I saw it in IMAX, full volume, a hushed audience. Mm. I've also seen it in Ornery, surrounded by people talking all the way through the film, which I think is going to be a common complaint because you kind of want to talk about it as
it goes
through.
Were they talking as in where are we now? Who's he? Where are we going?
They were just talking all the way through and eating and munching all the way through. So it's really not a fair comparison. Okay. But there is another point about going to see it the second time, which a follower to Wittertainment on Twitter, which I do encourage, pointed out about going to see it a second time, saying, isn't part of the enjoyment of seeing it being a bit lost?
Yes,
and
I think
there is a point there.
It is, although I have to say that part of the enjoyment of seeing it a second time is seeing how well it fits together and seeing how well, with the exception of one plot point which has been brought up, which we can't discuss because it was a lovely email that came in, which was a very simple who's driving the boat kind of question, which in order to read it out would be a plot spoiler.
Yep. So I'm afraid.
But who is the person who sent that email in?
I didn't even bring it in because I knew we weren't going to read it out. Because it's a very, very good, exactly as you say, who was driving the boat. But when everyone has seen it, we'll do it.
Okay, in the same way, after you can do the Dumbledore moment, can't
exactly.
you?
Exactly. Alice Floyd, Dear Skeleton Cupboard, long-time listener, just seemed to have gone to a packed screening of Inception at the Ritzy in Brixton. The film was
lovely
amazing,
cinema.
Really, really jaw-dropping. However, when the girl next to me went to the toilet, I wanted to tell her that Mark has already told everyone that she'd be better off if she didn't and just waited till the end. I held my tongue, but only just. The podcast, she says, has saved my life as I'm an insomniac and I listen to it to go to sleep. A lot of people appear to be doing this. An email which claims to be from A. Wachowski. Having just watched Inception, I went to the toilet, looked into the mirror and stared long into the void.
Very good. There's A rather than L Wachowski, right?
Indeed. Not everyone loves it. We'll get to some of those. I want to talk about the soundtrack as well in just a moment. Jack Murray says, Dear Wayne and Cobb, how can Kermode criticise Shutter Island's honking soundtrack and not even mention Inception's? It's more honk and prop than a million Shutter Islands. I thought Inception was good, but overhyped. Could have done with a bit more development for Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character. If you're wondering what the honk and prop is all about, this is what it sounds like. Absolutely love the soundtrack. It does this for the whole film. The whole film, it does this, and you don't get bored with it.
But when I was talking about the Shutter Island honk and being a prop thing, I didn't mean it as a criticism. I mean, I do think that it does. The score on Shutter Island does sound like Bernard Herrmann bringing a large ocean liner into dock. And you know, in this particular case, it's Hans Zimmer doing that stuff. I have no problem with it at all because the movie has that pumped up sense to it. It is that hyper stylized thing, and that's. Remember, silent movies were never silent. Silent movies were always accompanied by music. And what this is doing is taking it right back to that, which the score is harumphing its way through the film.
This is Stuart in Edinburgh, year five of the podcast. He says, Hans Zimmer's score to this film is sumptuous, immediate, epic and tender all at once.
How many more yards of epic and tender would you like, Mr. Nolan?
Jared in Japan. Rump and Tindlefink, I saw Inception today, completely satisfied. But for me, the most satisfying part of the entire film was the soundtrack. I usually bolt for the door when the credits roll, but with Inception, I found myself waiting. A truly wonderful score. Spoilers, Mr. Ambassador.
Shall we start a thing now, which is whether or not you can place a bet now for whether that score is nominated for an Oscar in 2011? Because I bet you it's going to be.
Sam Lewis, long-time listener, first-time writer. Love the show, Steve. Quick word about Inception. Went in with slight misgivings, having thought from the trailer and lead actor that it bore more than a passing resemblance to the underwhelming Shutter Island. Although I'm surprised the good doctor has yet to pick up on the similarity in the honking soundtrack. Yet, how much more interesting and intelligent it was, my main point is to say how very refreshing it was to see a blockbuster that didn't infantilise the audience, but treated them as discerning audience members. Right, so a lot of people love it. There are a few people who have some thoughts. Jack Johnson.
A lot of people love it. There are a few people who have some thoughts.
Okay, stupid sentence. All right. And they're not quite so keen. Jack Johnson, but presumably not the singer. I feel compelled to share my worrying view of Inception.
That would be Jack Jones, the singer.
No, or the trade union leader. Jack Johnson, the laid-back surfer dude.
Okay, as you were.
You ought to check him out. He's quite nice. One album's enough.
You ought to check out Jack Jones. He was in a horror movie, incidentally, Jack Jones.
At first, I doubted myself by thinking, let's not talk about Jack Jones, the singer.
You brought him up.
Yes, no, I brought up Jack Johnson. Because Jack Johnson is a listener and a surfer dude who is a very successful million-selling album.
Okay, he's a very nice guy. Successful million-selling album.
I felt compelled to share my worrying view of Inception. Oh, deja vu all over again. At first, I doubted myself by thinking I must be the only Christopher Nolan fan not to be fully engaged or understood of the intentions of the material. Am I stupid? Is it really as good as everyone claims it to be? Doubting myself, I forked out for a second viewing. I was apprehensive due to my last mental diagnosis of myself in the film. Disappointingly, I left again with that sinking feeling of boredom and sheer disappointment. I hate saying it. Why can't I experience the splendour and genius of Christopher Nolan and his much-praised Inception witnessed by the majority in the darkened gloom of the auditorium. I'm tired of even talking about this, as it pains me to even write something that I so wanted to enjoy. What was it that I missed?
Go see it again.
Well, he has been to see it.
Once?
Twice. No, he's been to see it twice, yes, as he
twice.
Said.
Oh, you know, yeah, you're right, yes.
Well, try listening.
Third time lucky.
Matt in Toronto. I went to see it with a high anticipation. The concept, special effects and action sequences were excellent. However, the film as a whole is like a fluorescent light, technically brilliant, efficient and cold. The plot's ambiguity is distinguishing between dream and reality. It has the consequence that the viewer is never invested emotionally in either the world or the characters. Observing someone else's dream, while interesting, is not emotionally engaging. The final question of what reality is, can I read this one out? Yes, I think so. Has little resonance because none of the possible realities have been drawn sufficiently for you to care about them. You are therefore left admiring the film while never being fully engaged by it.
Can I say something very quickly about that? Which is,
it would be a first.
It will. Yeah. Vanilla Sky was on telly the other day, and I was surprised at how much in its final movement there is a crossover there. As indeed, as others have pointed out, is there with Life on Mars, Series 1 and 2.
This from Dr. Tim Webster. Taking your advice, I concentrated hard during this film. I took no loo breaks. I gave the film that 30 minutes required to settle into the language and themes. I've got to say, I didn't get it. I don't mean the plot or whose subconscious are we in. I mean the hype. The film had great scenes, stunt work and cinematography, but the whole piece seemed lacking. None of the characters appeared well-drawn. In fact, all except DiCaprio seemed entirely 2D, or I suppose 1D, depending on your perspective. Mm-hmm. The rules appeared to change at times, and the script kept adding new aspects, such as Limbo Land, which didn't particularly seem to add up. I felt myself towards the end not particularly caring what happened.
So Limbo Land doesn't add up, you know. Yeah, it does. Makes perfect sense. Didn't Limbo Land make sense to you?
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Dear Catholic Church, this whole limbo concept.
Dear Mark Bay and Simon Nolan, who's this? Andrew Denny. I've been to see Inception. I've seen a few films which insulted my intelligence, but golly, this is the first one that insulted my stupidity. I think a film like this would actually benefit from a few more spoilers. I lost track of where you were in the real world and when in dreams. Perhaps different levels of colour saturation would have helped. Or perhaps that was the idea of setting the final sequence in a James Bondian ice fortress. It was in a different colour. Anyway, so he's a little bit...
No, but the getting lost thing is... That whole point about one of the joys of the film is the sense of being lost in it, which is why the Ellen Page line about, I'm sorry, whose subconscious are we in at the moment, is funny. Because you do get that sense of I'm just as lost as they are.
Ray in London, dear chess piece and spinny thing, which makes sense when you've seen the film. Did anyone other than me think, upon seeing Golden Locked Leonardo DiCaprio washed up on shore? I think we can talk about this because it's right at the very beginning. in the opening scene of Inception that they'd actually inadvertently walked into the long-awaited, at least by me, sequel to Titanic. He even had the same pose as when we last saw Jack sinking into the icy depths of the Atlantic. Does this mean that the original was just level one of the dream? From now on, I'll no longer be scoffed at when telling people what my favourite film is, citing it as Inception, the prequel.
But that would be great, though. If he did, he washed up on the shore like that, and then Kate Winslet could come along and go, Jack, you've grown up and turned into a half-decent performer. And incidentally, I forgive you.
Marcus, yes, indeed, you did forgive him. Marcus D. Spinkle. What a movie. Having prepared myself to take as many mental notes of everything as possible, the first 10 or so minutes took a bit of understanding. But once I had the premise of the film understood and accepted, the film was beyond what I had hoped for. Action, intellect, brilliant set pieces, and throughout the entire length of the film, I felt totally engaged with everything that was going on, all on the various levels of consciousness. And the final coming together of all the plot strands was done with grace, and my pre-film hatred of the cinema was actually forgiven. Nolan is genius, both with pen and the camera, and I'm going to be placing some early bets on some Oscar nominations.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I thought that email was going to go into, actually, I understood it all, and it was really in the way that some people go and do their math GCSE and go, yeah, I did that, it's a piece of cake. But I'm very glad that email went a different way.
Dear Julian and his friend
Sandy. How many of these emails are there? There is literally, when you said there's a bucket, there is like a whole bunch.
We're going to do Toy Story 3 after 3 o'clock, because that has a whole bunch as well. Fellas, I love the show and all that stuff, but I'm going to get straight to the point. I have a feeling I may be the only person in the universe who didn't like Inception, and I didn't like it not just a little bit. I thought it sucked big time. In fact, you could say it didn't work on any level. Now, perhaps I built it up too much in my head. I was really looking forward to it. An intelligent blockbuster by the Dark Knight guy with the Titanic guy and the Juno girl and the Irish guy with the weird eyes and the Bronson guy and even Charlie Croker. I was well excited. But it failed, and I'll explain this by telling you how it made me feel. Yeah. It made me feel empty, missing something, cold. It was as if someone had just waved a steaming hot saveloy under my nose only to snatch it away again the moment I began to salivate. Sorry, I just really like saveloys, he said. As I got up to leave, I saw a room full of people just like me shuffling towards the exits, mumbling. It was very clever, wasn't it? But all the while looking furtively at each other for a sign, a glimmer, a wink, a nod, a nudge, anything that would reassure them that they weren't the only ones to notice the Emperor wasn't wearing much.
Well, that thing about it's very clever, isn't it? I mean, what I'd say in response is I think that it does offer action spectacular, you know, huge big set pieces and romping adventure of the kind that we have come to expect from James Bond movies. I just can't remember last time I saw that level of visual indulgence tied to a script which was clever. And I don't mean clever, I mean clever. I mean, there is a difference between clever and clever. I think the thing with Inception is, it's what it assumes is the audience is smart. It's not doing that, ooh, we're so clever and twisty, you can't keep up. It's going, come on, keep up, because it knows that you can. And I am just thrilled that a film that cost that much money and looks that good gets the audience to run that hard behind it. And I think if you came out of it and everyone went, well, it was clever. Yeah, when was the last time you saw a huge blockbuster movie about which you could say that?
Five Live started the programme with Mark saying that Twilight is better than Star Wars. Craig in Newcastle. Could you direct this to Mark, please, Simon? After he reckons that soppy vampires are better than good versus evil swooshy lightsaber fun in space. Mark, you are dead to me now. Cheers from Craig.
But just read the sentence describing Star Wars.
Good versus evil swooshy lightsaber fun in space.
I think that's if they'd called it that, you see. I mean, in its defence, obviously, Empire Strikes Back, great. As they say in Clerks, or whichever film it is, Return of the Jedi, Muppets in space. And that's the thing that brings the trilogy right down. If you'd said, are the first two Star Wars movies better than the first two Twiglet movies? Yes. If you get into the trilogy, the first three Twiglet movies, including the David Slade film, are better than the first three Star Wars movies, including Muppets in Space, which, let's face it, is only a hop, skip and a jump away from the Ewoks Christmas special.
So, on the subject of trilogies, brings us to Toy Story 3, because last...
Do you see how I did that?
Yeah, last week you were talking about this being the greatest trilogy ever. David in Toronto, animated trilogies can't be compared with regular trilogies.
Why?
Live action movie... I'm about to finish in the email. He explains the comment. Okay. Live-action movies with actors in them are limited to what they can do even with special effects. With animated movies, there are endless possibilities. So comparing Toy Story to The Godfather or Mad Max or Back to the Future is unfair. It's like comparing AC/DC to Ella Fitzgerald.
What?
And Robert says... I would like to say that Lucino Visconti's German trilogy, Antonioni's trilogy on Alienation, and Ozu Noriko's trilogy are probably better, or at least as good, as Toy Story.
I disagree. Actually, the Ozu one...
I think I disagree with it.
I mean, it was interesting, because when I was trying to think of comparative trilogies, I was thinking of the Kieslowski, but of course White isn't up to scratch.
No.
It's a funny thing with the Ozus, because it has become now absolutely standard for everyone to cite Ozu as the
everyone
thing.
Does it.
I mean, you did it just the other day.
I was in the queue for the... I can't remember where I was going to see Inception again, and that's what they were talking about. They were saying, do you think 3 surpasses Ludwig, Eclipse, or Tokyo Story? But I'm not, you know, that's what they were. They were just down there and discussing that the whole time. Everyone is talking about that.
You see, Tokyo Story is definitely a 5-star film. Toy Story 1 is a 5-star film. There's nothing wrong with it at all. The difference is that actually I think 2 and 3, it's just to go up from 5. It's like, where'd you go from here? 11.
Now, we've kind of talked about Toy Story 3.
You went a bit Nigel then.
With really?
You said, we kind of talked about Toy Story.
Okay. I think we've mentioned Toy Story 3, and a lot of people have seen it. However, its official release day is today.
Today.
Toy Story 3, then, Mark.
Well, you want me to review it again?
Well, I don't know. Just give us some thoughts.
Well, the thing that I think is most interesting about it is that, as you probably know, because it has effectively been out for a week, and a lot of people have already seen it, and there's been some discussion about why it is that it's the film that's making men, grown men, cry. I wrote a piece for the Radio Times, which I think is in the current issue, and I said this before on the radio as well, in which I was comparing it to the final chapter of Winnie the Pooh, that there is a small chapter at the end of Winnie the Pooh in which kids don't respond to particularly because nothing happens in it, but the parents who are reading it to the children almost can't get through, in which Christopher Robin takes Pooh out to a certain area in the Hundred Acre Woods and effectively says, I'm going because I'm growing up and I'm going to leave you behind, but it's okay because you've got the other toys. And it's heartbreaking. And there is a certain element of Toy Story 3, not for one minute that I think that it won't work with kids, because I think there's so much going on. There's action and adventure and scary bits, the big scary baby doll, all that stuff is scary. But there is an element in it which, when you are of an age, when you have put away childish things, when you have put your toys in the loft, when you have left those things behind, is, if anything, even more poignant. That's not to say for one minute that I'm saying that Toy Story 3 is a film for adults rather than children. What I'm saying is it's a great film that if you are an adult, there's a whole level of it that works that's heartbreaking, that I think is more heartbreaking the older you are. And obviously when you're as old as us, that's very heartbreaking indeed.
Christine Edwards, who's never written to a radio show before, says, I listened to your review programme yesterday, as I do every Friday. It's my favourite radio programme.
Oh, really?
She said, always promising. Mark, talking about the end of Winnie the Pooh, we're talking about Christopher Robin. Where it takes Pooh to an enchanted place at the top of the forest and tries to explain that he'll not be able to play with him so much anymore. This is the very last paragraph.
Is this the paragraph that does this?
Yeah. Okay. This is the very last paragraph, in case you don't know what Mark's talking about. Okay. So they went off together. But wherever they go and whatever happens to them on the way, in that enchanted place on the top of the forest, a little boy and his bear will always be playing. You're welling up now.
Oh, yeah, stop it. Yeah, yeah.
So Christine is reading this. And she says she's just explaining this and reading, going through this whole thing. He asked why I was so upset and then said, you're not going to send me away to school, are you? I said, of course not, but was much more upset by it than him. The pathos was a bit lost on him, which I think is the point Mark is making. Last night, I went to the late night showing of Inception at Cineworld in Glasgow with the same son, now aged 21, and his friend, having listened to Mark's glowing recommendation. So I'm just tying the two together. Mm. And Inception was all he said it was, complex, confusing and entertaining, and I really need to see it again. Now, on the same point... check out this from Gary in Edinburgh. You ready?
Is this...
Okay. Go on. Dear Fran and Anna, as a new and first-time parent, I took a lull in yesterday's activities to catch Toy Story 3 in 3D. And yes, I must agree with Mark that surely this must be the first flawless trilogy in movie history. wonderful, exciting, inventive, scary, you name it, this film had it. By the end, I was a blubbering wreck, and for the first time in my cinema viewing history, I had to utilise my mostly manly of coughs to disguise my rather loud sob from the children sitting nearby. Actually, this might be a kind of warning. Actually, rehearse your manly cough.
Yeah.
Right.
That's got it.
Here's why I was so affected. I first went to see Toy Story when I was 13, and of course was blown away by this CG computery nonsense that surely wouldn't catch on. Just as Mark spoke of every adult's realisation that we all eventually put away childish things, the credits rolling on Toy Story 3 was, in many ways for me and a generation of youngsters, a parting glance at old friends. For those of us who have watched them time and time again in the intervening years, as we have grown up, this was a fitting goodbye to our own childish things. You see, there's a generation of people looking at it slightly differently. But no, I thought, as a father to a beautiful new daughter, I would come to experience the films through her eyes all over again in the years to come. Buoyed by this thought, I bounced home to see said bundle of joy, but no sooner was I back in the house with her in my arms when I realised what I had never seen or couldn't see until today.
Are you ready? You're going already, aren't
I should try and get through this paragraph. All along, these wonderful films have shown us that it isn't just Woody's story of loving Andy we have watched, but is also a story of all parents who, as best friends and treasured possessions of their children, dread that inevitable day when we too are played with no longer. Isn't that something else?
Yeah, that's lovely.
So here's Jason Littlewood running to the rescue.
Thanks for that.
I don't want to ruin an absolutely superb film, but I could have saved Pixar a lot of trouble in the writing process. Andy could just have given his toys to his little sister. 10-minute film, that's it. Few million dollars saved, though still wouldn't change the film at all. Loved it from start to finish. Keep up the good work. Yeah. But that would have worked, wouldn't it?
Well,
here you are, sister, here's the toys. We move on.
No, but there's also a question about whether they're boys' toys. Because there's one of the funniest things in Toy Story 3 is the discussion when there's the interview with Ken, when the interviewer says, how do you feel about basically being a girl's toy? And Ken said, I'm not a girl's toy, I'm a boy's toy. I'm like an action man. They said, no, you know, it's 80% of people that own Ken but as an appendage to a girl's toy. And he gets very, very huffy.
Interesting point from Steve Brindle, who loved the whole thing, but just a question on the certification.
Oh, yeah.
It's a U. Yeah. He says, surely this is the biggest misrating of a film since Star Wars, man choking to death in the opening 5 minutes. If Cars was rated a PG, then by that standard, Toy Story 3 should be a 12, which I don't think it should be, but it should be a PG. A young boy of four screamed to be taken home during the film because he was in such distress. His father did take him out. I had my son on my lap with me, promising in his ear it was going to be OK, whilst at the same time praying to myself that it was going to be OK, but I wasn't really sure.
There are certainly scary things in Toy Story 3. I mean, I think the Crusher scene is scary. I think the whole image of the great big, you know, one-eyed baby doll is very, very scary. In the same way that the first Toy Story, the bit in which they get taken off to the house of the boy across the street who makes strange toys, is very, very weird and creepy. And I like that very much. There is, at least on video, another category, which is UC, which is universal but specially suitable for young children, which is the kind of thing that Bob the Builder gets. I mean, instinctively, I'll go and look at the BBFC rating now. Instinctively, I would have thought PG, but, you know, yes, I mean, it's universal in that it's for everything. But, I mean, I think Snow White is still a U. And Snow White, of course, features really, really terrifying. I just think Fantasia.
That's not a U.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Because a little four-year-old. Oh, I'd love to watch Phantasm.
Sally Pugh in Kilmarnock went to see it with an audience of 4 to 84-year-olds. Within 5 minutes of the film starting, I felt myself welling up and by the concluding 10 minutes was sobbing. Looking around at the end credits, I saw that I was not alone in my blubbering. All around me, parents wept and hugged their children. Middle-aged men sniffed and concealed swollen, tearful eyes behind 3D glasses, and throughout the cinema, people stayed in their seats for the entirety of the credits so as to let their eyes dry before they exited the cinema, which I think is an interesting point. So God bless 3D.
Yes, exactly.
Is the answer. On that subject, Anne in France Like Mark, I'm going to watch Toy Story in both flat and wobbly D before drop-kicking 3D into the waste basket for good. If Pixar can't do it, then no one can. Last July, however, I had the humongous privilege to see the brain-achingly funny Natural Theatre Company do A Night at the Bijou at the Little Theatre in Bath, taking all of us back to the glorious 1950s. We saw Bride of the Monster, enhanced by, wait for it, not only Electrovision with real live lightning, but Wetarama with a dark and stormy night simulated by Honey and Gladys in the Usher as the Usherettes with thunderboards and squirty bottles, Smell-o-mation immersing us biologically right in the narrative, but also 3D grope around when the giant octopus gets aggressive, with real-life rubbery tentacles of doom emerging from the darkness on bendy poles wielded again by the indefatigable Honey and Gladys. Those peddlers of a mere 3D visual dimension as progressive and exciting ideas simply have no clue how high the bar has already been set. Fobbed off with mere gimmicks, we will not be.
Feelorama. That's from Kentucky Fried Movie, isn't it?
Chris in Whitstable, Dr. Kermit's analysis of Toy Story is spot on. Besides being a great kids' film, Toy Story 1 was also about the sorrow that the parents of young children experience when they think of how they must let their little ones go. Brilliant, brilliant storytelling. A query from Andrew. Have they solved the problem of weight? I've emailed you about this before, but you haven't mentioned it. The key is CGI doesn't convey weight. Characters seem to float. This isn't usually a problem with traditional cell animation. Bugs Bunny, Roadrunner, Tom and Jerry, Fred Flintstone, Barney Rubble, they all seem to weigh. But most CGI seems to float, and even lumpen characters like Shrek or Monsters, Inc. look halfway to being helium balloons. Mm-hmm. Does Toy Story 3 solve the problem? Do the characters weigh?
I was certainly less troubled. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I've referred to it myself. I was certainly less troubled by the lack of heft and weight in Toy Story than I have been in other CGI movies like The Clash of the Titans or anything, something like that. So, I think that they're... I mean, bear in mind the way that, for example, when they were doing cell animation with Disney, when they did Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, they did this, you know, it's rotoscoping, that they would get people to dress up in suits and then dance around, and then they would draw around them so that they had the sense of how the clothes would fall, how the bodies would bounce, and then they would then use them as the blueprint for the dance sequences. And because rotoscoping is a technique that's gone, I mean, Don Bluth did an awful lot of it. Recently Richard Linklater did it, you know, electronically. But there is, rotoscoping does often solve those problems. It is a weird thing with CG, though. It does definitely have weightlessness, but it wasn't an issue for Toy Story.
I would imagine that really, really big box office numbers are going to wait for a while, aren't they? They're going to wait for
Inception
and Toy Story 3. They're going to bulldoze everything out of the way for a while, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would think those two are absolutely filling the multiplex screens. But interesting stuff out this week, starting with Splice, which is the new film by Vincenzo Natali, who directed Cube, which we've seen a lot of sort of rip-offs of ever since he made that for almost no money at all. Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley are scientists called Clive and Elsa. And as soon as you have scientists called Clive and Elsa, or as soon as you have somebody called Elsa, what do you think?
What am I supposed to think?
Well, you think Elsa Lanchester, and then Colin Clive. I mean, basically,
why would I think Elsa Lanchester?
Because scientists. Because the whole film has a sort of Frankenstein thing going on, and when the two central characters are called Clive and Elsa, you go, okay, fine, I know it.
Do I?
Right. Well, one does. They are.
You might.
Yes, one.
If that's
does.
What you think, obviously get in touch, because I think everyone else will go, okay, what?
It's like if you had a film in which two characters were called Bert and Ernie, right? You'd go.
They're called Bert and Ernie.
No, you'd go Muppets, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I suppose so, if I thought about it for a while.
Fine, okay. So, they are scientists working in a laboratory that is generating new life.
What are they called again?
They're called Clive and Elsa.
Right. Ah.
Okay, fine. So, and they have come up with a new...
Is that Elsa Lanchester?
Yes.
Oh.
Elsa Lanchester, she of...
Coventry Polytechnic? Used to be called Lanchester Poly.
Did it? Okay, no, fine. Bride of Frankenstein to the rescue, but for you, that's fine. Okay, so, anyway, moving swiftly on.
Where were we? What's this film?
This is Splice by Vincenzo Natali. So they are working in a laboratory which is doing a whole bunch of genetic research. They have come up with a strange leathery creation, which they seem to have created, you know, entirely. It looks like a strange globulating leathery mess. When we are
is
told,
it David Copperfield, the magician?
Very good. We are told that within this new creation is a whole bunch of sort of genetic stuff, which will do things like cure diseases and sort of aging and do infinitely interesting things. But our heroes want to take things on to the next stage, which is by mixing what they've got with human DNA. Obviously, they're not allowed to do that because they have very strict rules about, you know, how you can and can't. But they get carried away, or she gets carried away, says, come on, let's do it anyway. Let's take a bit of human DNA. Let's put it together. Let's see what happens. So they get a bit of human DNA. They splice, there's the title, splice it together with the leathery, strange, bug-like creature that they have already. And bo and behold, they turn up with a new creature that starts off as a strange, scribbling, scuttling little gribbly thing. But as it grows, starts to look more and more like a human, but with strangely insect-like or bird-like or reptilian or strangely mutant buggy qualities.
Flappy wings.
He's worried. She treats it as her daughter. Now, I'm going to play you a clip. Yeah, because it's a she. There are only two, although there's a strange hermaphrodite thing going on. there was only two clips of this movie. One of them was extremely unlistenable. This is the most listenable audio clip.
The more listenable. Of the two.
The more of the two. Yes, that's right. Thank you. Here we go.
Why are we taking all these risks all of a sudden? What is going on?
When did you get so scared of everything?
When did you stop being a scientist?
No! Stop. You go to your place. Go to your place. She's not going to hurt. Okay, so we have to deal with this.
In years gone by, all of those noises would have been Percy Edwards.
Yeah, that's right.
Every single one of them.
Percy Edwards did famously do the noise for some alien movie.
Did he
didn't
do
he?
Alien? I think he might have done Alien. Anyway, was someone will tell us.
Yeah, he did something that you don't expect it to have been him, but it genuinely was. Anyway, so the interesting thing when we were playing that clip was you laughed.
Yeah,
and in the screen,
fine.
In the screening that I was in, there was also a fair amount of laughter. And I spent some time wondering about whether the laughter made me cross or whether actually the laughter was acceptable, because the movie, in a very interesting way, both manages to flirt with macabre satirical comedy as well as being sort of deadpan serious at the same time. It's a very Canadian film in as much as it's, you know, very David Cronenberg, very Atomic Goyne. Of course, Sarah Polley has worked with both of those people anyway. And it has that strange, cold, chilling, satirical, slightly removed quality that actually you do tend to get in movies that come out of Canada rather than movies that come out of America. Its closest cousin would be, if you've seen the David Cronenberg film The Fly, I mean, people have referred this to The Fly because obviously The Fly is the film in which Jeff Goldblum mutates into Fly. Interestingly enough, the original ending of The Fly was meant to be that Gina Davis actually produces this butterfly child who is the sort of the strange mixing of her and Jeff Goldblum, and all the DNA comes together to produce this thing, which is not a bug, but is actually a sort of beautiful butterfly. Funnily enough, that idea seems to echo all the way through Splice, that what they've created in Dren, she's named Dren, which is nerd, spelt backwards. Get it?
Well, now that you've pointed that out.
Fun. So they've created this show, but there's a whole tension going on between them, which is that he wants to have kids, she doesn't want to have kids, but she has this strange maternal relationship with Dren. He, on the other hand, having wanted to have kids and having refused to see Dren as anything other than a creation, then becomes involved in a way which is much more sinister, much more complicated, and much more, I have to say, awkward in order to handle. So the film, on one level, is metaphorically a really twisted family drama with dealing with really dark, strange subjects. On the other hand, is a strange, gribbly monster movie with a great sense of fun. I mean, there is one scene in it in which they have this great big exhibition in which they demonstrate the wormy-like reptile creatures that they've got, and they want to show everybody how fabulous they are, and it turns into something, you know, resembling a splatterfest. But very much in that Cronenberg way, the splatter is always done in a surreal, plastic reality way. I mean, there are plenty of moments in the movie that you go, ew, but not in a camp way like that, but in a sort of surreal, slightly Salvador Dali, you know, eyebrow raised, monocle, you know.
I'd like to do one of
floppy
those.
How would that wristwatch
how can
kind
I go
of way?
Ooh, in a Salvador Dali wristwatch.
Clearly,
kind of way.
I can't even begin to do it because I can only do camp. The Cronenberg references go even further. I think there are points in Dren's evolution when she looks, to some extent, like the Mugwumps from Cronenberg's adaptation of The Naked Lunch, and there is certainly, you know, a great design similarity there. It's one of those films in which some of the ideas work. I mean, all the ideas are interesting. Some of them work. Some of them hang together. Some of them are chilling. Some of them, sort of the more action-y sequences towards the end, you think they work as straightforward action-adventure fantasy. Occasionally, increasingly, as the drama moves on, it slightly loses its footing. I mean, in the same ways, as the creature grows and as the ambiguities about whether she's human, whether she's not human, whether the responses to her can be as one, you know, would have with a fellow species, as these things move on, the drama becomes slightly more uncertain. And I also felt that in the key moment at which the relationship basically fractures, they weren't quite sure which film they were making. There are certain times in it in which you feel as if within the production there's a tension between making a really twisted, really strange, really Cronenbergian, oddball, weird movie on the one hand, or on the other hand, making a movie that you think is going to have a massive, you know, mainstream appeal, is going to appeal to a blockbuster audience, is going to get people in who want to see an exciting fantasy adventure with monsters and people running around. And I think it never quite resolves those things. I think that's one of the reasons why in the screening that I saw there was laughter, and not all of it entirely appreciative laughter. So I think you'd have to say, hand on heart, it doesn't all hang together, but there's enough in it that's interesting and adventurous, and there's enough in the performances that very cleverly walks a line between keeping a straight face but understanding that what you're doing is, you know, is borderline satirical, which is done very well. I mean, there are certain sequences in it in which our hero and heroine are sort of crawling around on the floor, chasing around after gribbly monster parts, and you think this is entirely the sort of film which, when the director says cut, you're either looking at nothing at all because it's a CGI, or you're looking at some strange rubbery creation that's run by three guys holding, you know, rods and bits of string. And their performances are very good. It's very, very hard to act in this kind of movie. It's very hard to act in a movie when you're acting against a strange alien creature, as anyone who's ever made a monster movie will tell you, and they do a very, very good job. So it's not by any means flawless, but it's interesting and it's ambitious and it's engaging, and it's, I think, romping enough to at least tickle a mainstream audience, although I think in the end its weirdnesses, even though it tries to take the edge off them slightly, are still weird enough to keep it essentially to a cult audience. But I think it's the kind of thing that in years to come people say, did you see that splice? You know, it actually really was an interesting film.
Do you know how I know it's nearly 3:30?
I've stopped talking.
No, because Justine Green always arrives to read the news in a coat, which is, it's her last bulletin.
And not any old coat, but a new coat, Simon, especially for you.
I'd like you to wear a hat and scarf next time. Mike in Edinburgh just saw Splice at Glasgow. Oh, no, he's not just. Saw Splice at Glasgow Fright Fest. It's an absolute laugh fest. Total nonsense. Adrian Brody is awful. The ideas
he's not awful.
The ideas are stupid, and the love scene is literally the most laugh out loud, jump the shark moment I've seen for a while.
Actually, I was trying not to say what that scene. I think calling it a love scene is actually.
Okay. Van in Sheffield. Dear Doctors Frank and Stein, having just come from seeing Splice, wonderfully refreshing film in an era of constant diluted remakes and gore-soaked teenage torture flicks.
Yep.
A brilliant retelling of Frankenstein by way of a love letter to Cronenberg's The Fly. I found it to be easily one of the better films of the year. Now, if they can only avoid the trap that they fell into with Cube and avoid making any bloomin' awful sequels, it'd be just about perfect. I'd rather an engrossing and original film like Splice than another mess like the recent Nightmare on Elm Street remake any day.
As you said, that's going on the poster. Easily one of the better films of the year.
Nick, on this, dear Mr. Potato Head. No, that's the wrong one. Clearly, that's going to take us back into Toy Story 3. It's Tim Burnett's email I was looking forward to. Dear Deformed Experiment 1
and Deformed Experiment 2.
That's more like it. I had the pleasure of attending a screening for Splice in the presence of the good doctor a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure whether Mark was having a particularly bad day, but he seemed to be in rather an irksome mood. No, Tim, that's just kind of fairly standard. After passing him in the lobby and overhearing his conversational nugget, never trust a band without a bass player, I and the whole audience felt the Doctor's wrath during the movie. As the film reached its climax, an irritable voice bellowed from the front row,
"Get your head down at the back!" Because the bloke had his head in front of the projector and hadn't noticed.
I quickly realised that it was Dr. K who was barking the order, and I've never seen a group of people comply so quickly to a command. Such was Mark's bellowing blast.
Here's a tip. If you're looking at a screen and there's a big black bit on the screen and you move your head and the black bit moves, get your head down!
That said, the movie was enjoyable and extremely weird. Not sure about the mutant nookie, though. Tim in London, BA Honours History and PG Dip Newspaper Journalism. Sam in Camden. Thanks for making me cry, says Sam. The reading of that last email now has me in floods of tears, but in a good way. I was digging my fingernails into my palms to try and control myself, and what I should have had is a manly cough halfway through. Maybe that would have helped.
Yeah, but thanks. You didn't tell me that you were going to do the last paragraph of Winnie the Pooh. You just went for it and then went, oh, you're welling up.
Thank you, Mark. Twilight is best. Now we worship you. A whole number. Because you said Twilight's better than Star Wars. That's it.
There was one half
the country now hates you. The other half loves
very quickly,
you.
There was a letter in the Radio Times, because I'd done a thing in the Radio Times about liking Twilight.
Do you want to mention that again?
What,
in the Radio Times. It's a very good article.
Thank you. But somebody wrote in a letter which said, I've just read Mark Homewood's article and it's fantastic. Somebody understands why it is that we like Twilight and we really threw it. And then it went, I'd just like to point out that I am, in fact, 75 years old.
Excellent. We need more people like that.
Exactly.
I'm just going to read this Inception email. We're kind of done Inception, but it's just an interesting email from Dr. Keir Shields, MA Camtab, MB Chur. Cantab, Newcastle.
Lots sure.
of. Yes, MBB Chur. B something or other.
Bachelor someone will tell of.
No, B C H I R. What would that be? Chiropody?
Bachelor. Oh, C H I R,
yes. What would that be?
Almost certainly Bachelor of Chiropody.
You say chiropody, I say
chiropody.
Let's call the whole thing off. Dear Dream and Reality, just seen Inception at the Tyneside Cinema, which Dr. K knows well.
I do, yeah.
It is impossible to do this film justice in the number of sentences that can be read out on radio, but maybe the following point at least can make the cut. There are two reasons why an audience may groan and laugh at the same time. One is if a really bad joke is delivered on screen. The other is the reaction stimulated by the final few frames of this film. Suffice to say, it is phenomenal reason to laugh and or groan, but no more can be said. Inception demands as much attention from its audience as Citizen Kane. He's wonderfully shot, and the last frame is arguably the most perfectly chosen of the whole film. I cannot agree more with Dr. K that this is art house meets blockbuster, and I think we can't do any more. Suffice to say that you know, the final frame is extraordinarily well chosen.
And I didn't go. I went ah, because there, you know. And I
you
know.
Went, my daughter said, "Ah, it's rubbish."
Just tell me, did you think?
I thought somewhere between the two.
So okay, fine. It's official.
Which that is a spoiler for people who are watching the live streaming, because clearly that bit there is one reality, and that bit there is another reality.
And you thought there.
I think there, but it's heading anyway.
I was. Yeah.
Shall we carry on?
Yeah.
So what else is new then?
Barrier.
Oh, before we go any further, Beecher is Bachelor of Surgery.
Thank is you. It?
Yeah. Thanks very much indeed for our top research team. So, yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Keir Shields is a Bachelor of Surgery as well as being MA Cantab. Also, hello to the Lego Jason Isaacs. The real David Morrissey, the real Stephen Fry, Michael Sheen, Cillian Murphy, and the Lego Fairport Convention. Because we haven't said hello to them so far.
We haven't.
So consider that done.
Hello to all of them.
What else do we have?
Barrier, as I keep saying, which is the latest from Giuseppe Tornatore, who made Cinema Paradiso, which everybody loves to pieces, although I've always been slightly underwhelmed by it. He also made that thing Stanno Tutti Bene, which was recently made as Everybody's Fine, starring Robert De Niro. Did you see that? Which is kind of, you know, the remake was not quite as interesting as the original. Anyway, so the story is, it's a sweeping epic. It played in Venice this... where are we now? We're in August. No, we're July now. So it was September last year. So it played at the Venice Film Festival in September last year, in which it was nominated for an award, and it won an award. And I think it was Italy's foreign language film entry. So sweeping epic about set in this area, which is pronounced like spelt like as Barrier. And it's a whopping 151 minutes long. And it was funny that as we went into the screening, because the film critics go and see the screenings on Monday and Tuesday, there was this sort of sense of 151 minutes, and blimey, that is a long film. So it did have epic written all over. It spans three generations. Central character goes from being a young child to some, you know, of sheep rearing stock, to somebody who grows up, has political ambitions, becomes a sort of career communist, starts to do, you know, well in the local council, has various political battles with the other political parties, and also peripherally with the Casa Nostra and, you know, and the Mafia. What's interesting about this is whenever you see sweeping historical epics set around, you know, this Sicilian land, you expect there to be a lot more of the kind of the presence of the Mafia. Actually, this is it's quite a change because that isn't so true. It's there on the outside, but it's essentially a family drama, a story about people growing up. It has great flights of fantasy. It starts with the scene of a little child being told by one of the villagers, if you can get down to the shop and buy me a packet of cigarettes, by the time my spit on the floor has dried up, I'll give you some money. And the kid runs, and the kid runs, and the kid runs, and the kid runs, and then suddenly the next thing, the kid is flying, and the kid flies off over this landscape through which I suppose he then views the ensuing drama. And at the very end, we come back to where we began, and a later version of the child passes a younger version of the child. So there are these kind of great flights of fancy, and there are also tropes within it, little motifs that clearly hark back to Giuseppe Tornatore's, you know, better known works. There is, for example, a scene in which the young kid has little outtakes of movies, you know, movie frames in which he keeps and which he swaps like trading cards, and he loves them and he tends them and he looks after them. And it is all to do with that love of cinema and that fascination with cinema and the kind of growing epic landscape. The fact that the whole thing, incidentally, is shot on a massively constructed set, which apparently was built in Tunisia. So all the, I mean, I was looking at it not knowing this, thinking, wow, that's incredibly authentic. And it turns out the whole thing was built on a set. And according to the IMDb, some staggering number of extras. I mean, it has all the things that you want from a, you know, from an epic in terms of sweep and scope. And of course, the great big sweeping Morricone score, which literally does the, there we go, sweeping historical epic, la 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 la, some more sweeping, I mean, not words, the, you know, there's a...
No.
Yes, you do.
I don't get that.
Yeah. You know, if something is a sweeping historical, there's a lot of things. I'm turned into a pub singer. But it's not a score that goes tinkly, tinkly, diddly bong. It's a score that goes, you know.
It's not Hans Zimmer.
Well, Hans Zimmer can do that, yeah. I mean, but Hans Zimmer in particular, what you were referring to before, Hans Zimmer Inception going, scary, 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 in somebody's mind, da-da-da-dum, going down, that's, into the subconscious, bum, 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 bum.
That's like that. One, Eddie Izzard, and two, Hans Zimmer with a D. Between the N and the S.
Hans Zimmer, very good. And then there's Hans Zimmer in Shutter Island, which is honk, which is basically, you know.
You just killed that mic. Apologise to our engineering staff and the transmitter maintenance team.
However, so there is stuff to like in Barrier. The problem with it is that it is long, it is indulgent, it is very, very, it basks in its own glow slightly too much. I mean, I thought the performances were engaging. There are elements of the story which I like. I mean, the fact that there's a political thread going through it, I quite enjoy. I like the characters and the fact that nothing really, really terrible happens between people, but things flow and ebb. But it is true that at 151 minutes, it is a long ask, and it is a film which seems, if anything, kind of content with its own sweepingness. It's so in love with the sweeping vista of its, you know, of its narrative plane that it kind of just wombles off for a little while. It's occasionally like looking at a movie that goes, I look great, don't I? I look great. I look great over here, and I look great over here. And here's a kid. They're charming, aren't they? Should we look through their eyes? Oh, looking through the kid's eyes. That's charming. What would you like? You'd like to see the kid fly? There goes the kid fly. And there is a little bit of that, you know, whimsy tips over into, come on, come on, come on, get with it. But
what does whimsy tip into? What does it become like that?
I don't know. What does whimsy tip over into?
Post-whimsy.
0345, whatever the number is. So it... I didn't dislike
it. You've been paying attention for the last.
But
it was
two things to say about it. One of them was that Youth in, you remember that thing, Best of Youth, which was released in cinemas but was essentially a television program. This might well have done as a series.
Was Elsa Lanchester in that?
No, she wasn't in that. No, nor was Colin Clive. And the other thing was, it reminded me of what a good film Golden Door was, which is a very different film.
Is it?
Yes. But actually, there was something, it's about a family leaving and coming over to America. And whilst I was watching this, I started thinking at one point, it's a shame I'm not watching Golden Door because I rather more enjoyed that. But it's not without a certain sweeping charm. And on a Sunday afternoon, watching it, you might be swept up in it. Watching it on a Wednesday when you had other things to do, you might start to think, you know, get on with it. This is too long.
Dear Simon, says this email from Linda Ruth Williams, Professor of Film, English Department, University of Southampton, BA Honours First Class, MA Distinction, PhD, Sussex and the rest. Mm-hmm. Listeners may be interested to know that the Kermode-focused donkey saga continues in our venerable local press. You remember this is a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, I do remember this.
Read out an
donkey
article.
Gives critic bad review.
Yes, that's right, from the front page of
The Lymington Times.
From 1931. A letter from one David Marshall of Romsey was recently published in the Letters to the Editor section, a hotbed of local debate, says Professor Linder. What upset donkey? Sir, referring to the front page news item Lovelorn Donkey of July the 3rd, as a holder of a certificate in donkey behaviour from the Donkey Sanctuary,
oh, yeah,
allow me to explain the poor equine's behaviour. It is a well-established fact that an impeccably coiffured quiff is to a donkey as a red rag is to a bull. Yours, Linda.
And the fly.
There you go. So it was all your fault.
All my fault, yes.
Donkey, quiff, charge.
Moo.
That's what happens. Or even bray, I think was the word you're looking for, because they don't moo. Toy Story 3, on that subject, Tony on this text, Mark and Simon are now worried. This is about the certification.
Oh, yeah.
I've just booked tickets for Sunday to take my 7-year-old granddaughter to see Toy Story. She loves Coraline. Will she be okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Coraline's a lot more creepy. Yeah, it's fine. Coraline is a PG. I was going to say, if somebody can print out the BBFC certification thing, I'll read you exactly what things. But if you can't, otherwise, you could. If you want to know plot spoilers, go to bbfc.co.uk, put Toy Story 3 into the search engine, and then when it says extended information warning plot spoilers, if you click that, it will tell you every single thing in the film that might trouble your child.
Team Edward and Team Jacob, says Matt Croucher.
I'm Team Bella.
Who's in Phoenix, Arizona. I cannot confess that the podcast has saved my life, like previous listeners. I can say that the Good Doctor's reviews, typically condensed to Kermode said it was rubbish, have more than once saved me from having to watch a terrible movie suggested by my girlfriend. Although I did have to watch Valentine's Day, Hallmark card full of sick, as it was.
Yeah, it was.
My question, do the Good Doctors know of a legal way to obtain the back catalogue of Wittertainment? Is there an archive?
Isn't there?
Yeah, it's kind of all there. There is an archive of past reviews and flappy-handedness. It's online. Five Live website. It covers some. It's not all, but it does cover some of the best reviews going back a couple of years. So that's as far back as it goes. You can search for a movie alphabetically or by genre, should you wish. Sex and the City 2, Transformers, Marley and Me, that kind of stuff. There are some decent reviews, and then films that he likes. If you're jogging around the botanical gardens in Melbourne and want to, you know, slow down a bit, you head online to bbc.co.uk/5live, and the Wittertainment Review Archive is all there. Give us another movie.
City Island, which won the Audience Award at the Tribeca Film Festival, which stars Andy Garcia, who was also kind of the guy behind the production. The script came to him, he wanted to put it in play because it's an actor's project. Now, it's always a worry with anything that actors are behind. They tend to make film stories that are very actorly, or in some cases actually about acting. In this case, he is a prison guard or a prison orderly of some description. He has another way of saying that's what he is. Lives in City Island, which is actually a little island out in the Bronx, apparently, which I had never heard of before. Apparently, not many people have. It's a little fishing community out in the Bronx island. And he goes to work, where he works in a prison, and he has a secret life, which is that he goes to acting classes because he actually wants to become an actor, but he doesn't dare tell his wife that that's what he does because she will think badly of him. So he pretends that, in fact, he's going off to play poker with the guys. Whilst he's in prison, he comes across a prisoner that he realises is, in fact, his love child from several years ago, from 21 years ago. He decides, with what can only be described as a twisting of the plot, to take said prisoner back into the bosom of his house without telling either the prisoner or the family that this prisoner is in fact his son, whilst meanwhile revealing to a woman with whom he has become involved, but only intellectually, at acting classes, that this is what he is doing. Following this?
Not really.
Here's a clip.
So, Vince tells me that he was friends with your mother.
Yeah, long time ago, I guess.
I guess so. Because I never heard about it.
Well, that's because it was before we met Sweetie.
He says she was a very nice woman. Good looking, too, I bet.
Oh, here we go.
Mom, Dad's right. Why don't we just be up front here? Come out with it. Just ask him if he had sex with this woman.
Vince, apologize to me.
That's right. That's my brain tumor.
Well, he does have a point, sweetie. I mean, all due respect, it is what you were getting at. I mean, even though you're kind of...
Why are you two ganging up on me?
Come on, Joyce. You know, after 20 years, I know where you're going before even you do.
Well, that must be very boring for you, Vince. Really. Who knew that I was failing to keep you entertained all these years?
So here's the thing, City Island, there are things in it that are okay, there are things in it that are overripe, the plot convolutions are very, very fiddly and occasionally annoying, the story about the boys having a putative relationship with somebody across the road for reasons which are just too complex to go into, and it is one of those films that ties itself up in knots and is kind of pleased with its knots in a way which isn't entirely satisfying. That said, there are occasional moments in it that are sort of charming and funny and quirky. It does, however, suffer from exactly that thing. I mean, the fact that it was the audience award winner at the Tribeca Film Festival kind of tells you what you need to know. It's that sort of film. It is a film in which, you know, actors get together and do acting, and they obviously all really enjoy being together and working on a project that they were all, you know, very able to act in, and it's about acting. In fact, one of the funniest bits in it is when he's in an acting class in which Alan Arkin gives him a great big lesson about how Marlon Brando brought about the death of acting by pausing, and how he says he's wasted years of his life listening to actors pause, and he never wants to hear any pauses. He never wants that whole thing about watching an actor think. So if you're an actor, if you're a thesp, I'm sure there's much in here to enjoy self-referentially. I think beyond that, it doesn't have a huge life in cinemas. It just obviously didn't cost a lot of money, and it is a labour of love. And I do think that, you know, Andy Garcia is interestingly offbeat in certain ways. But again, there's a funny thing about it. You can go from quirky to irksome very, very simply.
So if you tip from quirk into
quirky to irksome, yes, but whimsy, I can't quite figure. You know, Mumsy with the Borogroves or whatever it was.
So, and it's where, what we're looking for is when whimsy becomes sort of less attractive.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the dangerous, edgy side of whimsy?
Whimsy, yeah. I don't know. I'm appealing to the audience. Can I quickly do The Rebound with Catherine Beta-Blocker?
You certainly can.
So the Catherine Beta-Blocker new film, The Rebound, story is she is a mother living with a husband. Turns out at the beginning of the film, husband is a philandering git. She decides to dump him to move with her children to New York City to start a new life. Is she going to be able to start a new life? Well,
I don't know.
Interestingly enough, her eye is caught by somebody who's working in the local coffee shop who is half her age. She needs a babysitter, but you know what? Maybe he's going to turn out to be more than a babysitter. Anyway, here's a quick clip of Catherine Beta-Blocker in The Rebound.
I found an apartment.
Wow, you're fast.
It's not great, but my husband won't be there, so that's a plus.
How are you so well adjusted?
All those years with the PTA, I've no other choice.
How's the job search?
I got one. Fact checker at SNN.
Are unbelievable. You're almost fully healed.
You know, everyone says what a nightmare it is to get divorced. I feel fine.
No residual or anything?
No. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. Trapped in some suburban hell, same thing day after day, like a hamster on a wheel.
So the thing about this is, it's actually, I mean, I went in expecting not very much at all, and coming out thinking, well, you know what, I enjoyed it kind of more than I thought I was going to. Firstly, the fact that it's a, what do they call them, May-September romances, and you usually see that the other way around. It's usually like Woody Allen and, you know, Mariel Hemingway or you know, the age gap is usually the other way. So it's quite nice to see that reversed, okay, firstly. Secondly, Catherine Zeta-Jones is a strange screen presence because she's kind of, you know, she's icy and chilly and removed in some way, in ways that in the past I have not found entirely easy to empathise with. Funnily enough, in this film, she does have a certain degree of comic charm that she uses rather well, and she plays an awkward, spiky character in a way that seems perfectly appropriate for the role. So I actually thought she was not bad at all in it. There are certain parts of the film that seem to have, you know, a kind of casual comic honesty, which I quite like. They are, however, balanced against moments of very broad and very ill-judged comedy, none more so than the scene in which she goes out on the first date with somebody who is thought by her contemporaries to be an appropriate partner. And in order to demonstrate that he's not appropriate at all, and in fact what she should be doing is sending her affections towards this much younger man, the guy that she goes out on a date with, there's suddenly a whole subplot about him constantly going off into toilets to go to the loo at great length and then not washing his hands. And it seems to be something that's come out of an utterly different film. I mean, it's bowel humour in the middle of what otherwise is a sort of strange that wrong. And it's broad, and the screening that I was in, a couple of people laughed and shrieked, but I think a few more people went, well, why are you doing these gags now? It's almost like you've lost confidence in the central thing. The other thing that's wrong with it is in its third act, it goes off into montage hell. There is a montage in the third act which is unforgivable and is really one of the worst montages I've ever seen. And there is also an interesting screen widget, which is that as the film progresses, it's necessary for other people to grow up, but for Catherine Beta-Blocker to remain exactly the same age. So actually what happens during the course of the movie is at the beginning of it, the age gap between her and the young man is, let's say, you know, 10, by the end of the film, it's about three. He's aging, but she doesn't appear to be. It's like, you know, what's that film? Benjamin Button. You know, they're meeting in the middle.
The Curious Tale
of... The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. But it's finished. That said, it's not without chuckles. It's not without a certain degree of laughs. It was perfectly passable. And I mean, there is an awful lot wrong with it, but I thought it was absolutely fine in places.
We have a few weeks off, by the way. Boyd and Floyd picking up the reins as we have our summer resting period.
Yes, resting period.
Dear Woody and Buzz, just finished with Inception then. Enjoyed Inception the other night. This is Jim in Teddington. Wondered why it turned into On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
On Her Majesty's Psychiatric Service.
Of the way through, snowmobiles and all. Quite disappointed that some skiing henchman didn't disappear into the blades of a snowplow and get ejected in a shower.
So that he could say, I told you, egg guts.
Is Tom Hardy looking to take over James Bond? I have to say that one of the recurring themes is that everyone says Tom Hardy is
brilliant.
And not like he was in Star Trek, when he came in actually to talk about a Star Trek 7 spin-off, and that wasn't very good. But Tom Hardy is a brilliant genius.
He is.
Hello, Tom. So, movie of the week.
Well, for me, Splice. I mean, I'm assuming that Toy Story 3 opened last week.
So go see Toy Story 3.
Go see Toy Story 3. Go see Inception. But for this week, Splice.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.